Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Some time ago, I was doctoring in one of our local hospitals and was touched by the story of one of our patients. He'd been admitted to our hospital because of difficulty breathing, and we also noticed that his legs were massively swollen. He was a man in his late 50s who told us that he worked as a chef, but that he'd only been back doing what he loved after many years of personal troubles. Among his troubles were a descent into drug use, mental illness, and eventually homelessness. He lived on the streets of Tulsa for several years, in and out of shelters like the Day Center and John 316 that are valuable resources for those without. I was pleased to see that under the care of our medical team, the patient lost almost 30 pounds of water weight in 6 hospital days. He felt remarkably better, and the day before he was ready for discharge from the hospital, I walked into his room and met 2 gentlemen visitors who'd come to check on our patient. I was under the impression that the visitors were members of our patient's faith community, so benevolent was their interaction and so sincere the expressions of their concern. I struck up a conversation with the visitors, one of whom was Mike Bros, Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Tulsa. Though he has the demeanor and calm disposition of a clergyman, Bros is a warrior in the battle to increase awareness of mental illness, working to destigmatize those afflicted and provide services such as stable housing that are crucial to achieving balance for many of our society's dispossessed. The Mental Health Association of Tulsa is a United Way agency that has been devoted to advocating for those afflicted with mental illness and providing support to their family members since 1955. Bros has been the executive director since 1993, now entering his 3rd decade in the post. Mike Bros, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thanks, John.
How would you describe the mission of the Mental Health Association of Tulsa?
Well, we're working on behalf of people affected by mental illness and in all of its shapes and forms and sizes. And when we say affected, and we're not just talking about the individual who may, say, have a mental illness or a substance abuse issue, but if it affects one person, it affects a whole lot of people around them. So that's who we're referring to. But that's essentially the mission.
And who is your client base?
Well, people that we serve would be people affected by serious mental illness. When we use that term, serious mental illness, we're talking about people with schizophrenia, people affected by bipolar disorder, major depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, that whole range of very serious mental illnesses. But it's beyond that. People have been traumatized by life. All of us have been. It has an emotional impact and effect upon us. And again, they're family members, what have you. And so our clientele is, if you want to really, this sounds kind of cliche, it's everyone. Really, it is. Because we're all affected by these things. It isn't an us and them issue. It's just us.
How do people, whether they're clients or they're family members, how do they find out about your services?
Well, you know, people, a lot of times, again, there's a lot of confusion. Sometimes people think we're a mental health provider, if I can use that term, that we provide mental health services that are, say, billable to Medicaid or Medicare or another third-party insurance. We're not. We're a mental health education, mental health advocacy organization. And so now, do we do a lot of outreach to people? Do we do a lot of prevention work? Do we do a lot of we have our housing services that are well-known. We operate a drop-in center. We have a program called Metropolitan Apartment Program where we outreach to people who live in the community, who live in recovery with mental illness. We do those sort of things. But they find out about us from just everywhere, friends, family, from providers. You know, people just know about us. It may come from, you know, just every possible avenue that you can possibly imagine. You know, people know about us, find out about us, and are referred to us all the time, and it comes from all over.
All right, I want to ask about something that I know is very important to the Mental Health Association, which is housing, providing housing.
Right.
So what is housing first? I mean, what does that mean, and where does it come from?
Yeah, that's a really interesting. It's become the considered the best practice and the most, you know, evidence-based practice, as they like to say sometimes. The concept comes from, you know, when we used to try to solve homelessness, you know, it was like this. Like, hey, dude, you know, you're not looking too good. You look like you're maybe using substances of some type. You're not stable. You probably need to stabilize on some medication. Your clothing, you're tattered, you're disheveled. You know, you don't smell very good. You know, get all that straightened up and get all that stuff lined up. And, hey, then we'll help you find a place to live. And we'll help you get a job. Well, that's, you know, that is impossible.
Sounds like a long shot.
It's a long shot. It's a failed public policy. I think we can chalk it up, failed public policy. So along comes Housing First, and it was coined by a guy out of New York. His name's Sam Simbaris. And when we first heard him, about 12 years ago, we actually brought him to Tulsa to talk about what he was doing in New York. That was the first time he described housing first, and we all looked at each other and said, wow, we've been doing that. When what that means is trying to take all the barriers down to people who are homeless, people on the streets, people who are, you know, have been really habituated to the streets, take as many barriers down as you possibly can and move them into housing first. Why is that? Well, many of your listeners remember Maslow's need hierarchy. And what's, I always ask the rhetorical question, what's the first rung on the hierarchy? Well, shelter, safety, and security. So the idea of being in the hierarchy. So in other words, these individuals didn't even make it to Maslow's need hierarchy. They're not even on the hierarchy. So what we're doing by moving them into housing first, we're taking care of their shelter, security, safety issues by moving them into a living environment that is theirs, by the way. They rent, or we, you know, have ways through some of our grants to not have that be a barrier. We move them in. Then we wrap ourselves around, or we bring others from the community in based on what their particular need is, and we wrap services around them and help them stabilize in that housing. And so once that level of the hierarchy is taken care of, lo and behold, Maslow was right. They can begin to think about other things like their health care, like their mental health care, about getting clean and sober, about how they appear. It's really amazing. It's very powerful. I tell people it's very spiritual to watch that happen, to watch that transformation when people suddenly aren't worried about where they're sleeping tonight. And by the way, if you're living homeless, it's very scary. It's frightening. It's not safe in many ways, not just the weather, but I mean just physical safety. But if you're not worrying about where you're sleeping tonight, you're not worrying about your next meal, that I can be in my own little place, even how small it may be, then it's mine, the door's locked, I'm safe and secure. It's a very powerful spiritual thing to watch people sort of awakening to other things, and you start to see them begin to self-sustain again, and they begin to think about other things and how to improve their lot in life and what have you. And it's one of the coolest things is when people come around, and our staff always tells me that they come around after a while and they go, well, you know that little safe haven unit you got me in, it sure is small. I really would like something. Is there anything bigger? We love that. That's a sign that people are, it's really starting to take. They're starting to think just like we do, just like I do, just like you do. We all want a little, we have our what we call our Better Box Project. Everybody wants a little bit better box to live in, and no matter where you're at on the list. So it's pretty cool. So that's what housing first is, getting people into housing first, taking care of that bottom rung of Maslow's need hierarchy, and then setting the stage, laying the platform where people can again discover, sometimes for the first time, many times it's rediscover, self-sustainability.
Really, I was looking on your website, and actually just yesterday as part of OU's Summer Institute, I was able to pay a visit to the Yale Apartments, very impressive housing for mentally ill clients. And I just wanted you to share with the listeners some of the really quite staggering economics.
Well,
to the good.
Yeah, to the good. I mean, there's all kinds of research and data to show that, you know, the expense of leaving people homeless on the streets. One thing is, you know, people who are homeless on the streets, a lot of times the police get called because of trespassing issues, sometimes petty crimes, inebriate behaviors, what have you. That costs money. Then sometimes IMSA gets called, and then IMSA and fire respond to that. That costs money. Then sometimes people do get arrested, and they're in jail. That costs money. Then they got to go to court, and that costs money. And then they have serious health care problems, and they have to go to the hospital, and that's uncompensated. And sometimes they tend to be very sicker. There's some data to show that people who are homeless, if they're hospitalized, on average stay in the hospital 4 days longer than the general population. If you run the numbers on that, that's a significant amount of money. So, and that's why people don't, you know, we're trying to, the research shows clearly, it's much more cost effective and human effective to begin to, you know, get people into housing and help them stabilize there and help them, so then leave them on the streets. And that's why we've had this huge investment in Tulsa in developing affordable housing for these individuals, what have you. And Yale Apartments that you referenced, well, That was developed, you know, Gail Richards and Judy Kishner, they went out and raised money, public and private money, because the downtown YMCA was going to close. And it had to be closed because of the fire marshal. And it needed to be closed. They were getting out of the housing business. And but were we going to turn 150, 160 people out on the streets and wish them well? No, they went out, raised money. We built the Yale Apartments. And it's been an amazing thing. And, you know, I visited a guy's apartment yesterday on a tour. Any of your listeners are welcome to come out for a tour. We'll just contact me. We'll schedule it. But I went into this guy's apartment. His name's Glenn. He's a veteran. He was in the Navy. He moved in the first day we opened 3.5 years ago. He moved in from the Salvation Army. Moved in there. He still got his little apartment. He works during the day. In the morning, he helps clean some of the downstairs on the first floor, some of the commons areas. He helps clean, what have you. We pay him minimum wage. It's not a lot. He's disabled, and he has his little apartment. He's so proud of it, and we take him in there, what have you. And, I mean, it's an incredible thing to watch people, you know, get better and be happy. And I love to give tours because I love to introduce anybody when we go on a tour. I introduce them to people that live in our housing. I introduce them to our staff. And by the way, 55% of our staff have a history of substance abuse, and 36% of our staff have been homeless at least once. 25% of our staff, 1 out of 4, have at least 1 felony conviction. So what does that say to us? That says that this stuff works. People can recover, and we're doing it. That's why we've become a part of a, you know, nationally known, particularly with our housing programs.
What are the economics? On the website, at least, you're talking about an order of magnitude. I mean, the costs of incarceration or hospitalization, as you mentioned, the police costs, the fire costs, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars versus, you know, rent, I suppose, for this affordable housing that is in the really the low single thousands, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's dramatic. And that's been, you know, demonstrated over and over again. And we had one time a local community leader here said, oh, well, those numbers you're citing, those are New York City numbers. What does that have to do with us? So we actually, some of our funders actually commissioned Q2 Consulting, which are happen to be a private concern, but some of some TU professors, real smart people around here, and their team, and they did our local study. And what they were able to demonstrate is the numbers in New York, the numbers in Tulsa, while smaller overall, paralleled the numbers in New York City. And so, and now that's been replicated all over the country. It's been replicated to show that how much more cost effective. That's why HUD, you know, Housing and Urban Development, that's why SAMHSA, which is a federal agency, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is a small federal agency whose job is to make sure that other federal agencies don't do anything to contribute to homelessness and are working to end homelessness in our country. All of those federal agencies, our State Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, all say that housing first, the development of affordable housing for this population, moving people off the street, how much it works and how much it saves the community. And it's amazing because we're bringing down the overall numbers of homelessness across the country here locally, but we're also bringing the numbers around nationally, whatever. We're making a difference by the implementation of the housing first policies.
So I also saw that amazing reduction in homelessness in Tulsa. And I think your website quotes it as maybe it was the early 90s or mid-90s. There was over 1,000 regularly homeless people in Tulsa, and it's down into the few dozen.
Well, it's dropped down. You know, it dropped down under 100. We were in like at 200 in 08, and then we dropped down under 100. Now, that's a chronic homeless. That's a HUD definition. And this gets very confusing sometimes. We struggle with this internally. You know, HUD's focus has been on two pronged. One is rapid rehousing for people who have just become homeless. And then the other piece is people who are chronically homeless by HUD definition. Now, we happen to think this is way too long, which is their HUD definition is homeless continuous every day for a year or 4 times in the previous 3 years. Now, I'm telling you, John, that's hard living. And what we try to say is anything over 180, Tulsa definition, anything over 180 days is unacceptable. We want shelters. Shelters were never designed for people to live there. I think we've lost that. Shelters were designed as very temporary housing, and that people could get, you know, get out of the weather, get shelter, get services, get food, until very quickly they could return to being rapidly rehoused. So HUD's focused on the chronically homeless, which they should be. The people have been on the streets the longest. We're in Tulsa very much focused on that. And then on rapid rehousing, helping people, you know, be able to provide them the services and the vouchers that they need to get into housing very rapidly and not become chronically homeless. The problem is that gap in the middle between the rapidly rehoused and the 180 days and then the meeting the HUD definition. Because as we're going after the chronically homeless, the clock's ticking, and more people, we're not getting that middle group, and they're feeding back in. They're backfilling on us. The other backfill we've got are those kids that are coming out of foster care that are being basically released from state custody at the day they turn 18, and they're, in our opinion, are not properly prepared for, you know, life as a full-blown emancipated adult. I don't know about your listeners, but my son, he didn't cut that at 18, and most don't. But we've got to, you know, what we're trying to do is trying to fill in that middle gap. And so we've got to attack this on all these prongs, the rapidly rehoused, the people who are long-term chronic homeless. But we've got to do a better job of going after these people who are going to become chronic homeless. Because I like to tell people, these people weren't born chronically homeless. They became chronically homeless day after day after day on the streets. All chronic homelessness, if you really want to know maybe better terms, is people who have had to survive, they've had to adapt to life on the streets. That means panhandling, digging out of garbage cans, using all the homeless shelter stuff, living in encampments. This is no way for people to live, and we can do a better job, and we've got the technology, we have the know-how, and I think ultimately we're going to have the resources to be able to end chronic homelessness in Tulsa, and people will only be homeless if they become homeless. They'll only be homeless for a short period of time. I think it can happen in my lifetime.
I want to ask you about the logistics. So do you own the properties, or do you manage them, or both?
Well, we call it the Tulsa model. It's unique around the country. There are limited other examples, but we are kind of the shining example of a community that kind of did it our own way, which was to, rather than use tax credits, rather than using other sorts of just basically vouchers to private developers, which we do that too. All those things occur in our community, but we felt like it wasn't enough, and there are some vouchers tend to come and go. There's more sometimes than other times. Sometimes, you know, even tax credits have gotten problematic in some respects. What we did was to actually raise money, and then once we had the money, then to negotiate with available property and to buy the property and own it debt-free. And by owning it debt-free, then we're able to secure and make sure, one gets lost here, is we're helping to preserve affordable housing, because what's going on all over the country? Gentrification. Affordable housing is being torn down in many cities, and really expensive high-rises and expensive condos are being developed. And again, that increases to homelessness. So we're preserving affordable housing, as well as then, because we own it debt-free, we don't have a debt service to pay, we can help keep those rents really low. Because even with what we call our market rate, our independent apartments are not people who are strictly mentally ill, formerly homeless, people with histories of substance abuse, people who've had a history of incarceration. While they do live in our housing, half of the units are available for anybody. You or I or any of your listeners could rent one of our apartments. And we have a lot of people who live really on the edge of homelessness at very low income. And we need a lot of availability of, and we say market rate, it's really below market rate independent housing that you or I could rent from the Mental Health Association and just rent an apartment. So what that does is that mixes us all together, mixed use. If you come to our apartments, you can't tell who's who. Everybody looks the same, and we like it that way. And that way, that reduces stigma. It reduces people driving by and saying, hey, look at that apartment building. Everybody that lives there has a mental illness. Actually, people with mental illnesses live around us and work around us and live around us every day, but they are afraid to identify themselves as such because they're they're afraid of the prejudice and discrimination that comes their way.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Mike Brose, Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Tulsa since 1993. And we've been talking about stable housing for those afflicted with mental illness. And I wonder, you talked a little bit about your business model, as it were, for buying, developing properties, and then owning, managing them. Is the NIMBY phenomenon present? I mean, you described how you try to integrate affordable housing with, wraparound services for mentally ill. So is there less of the not in my backyard phenomenon where you have, folks in certain neighborhoods who are resistant to the idea?
Well, it's really interesting because that's a great question because, first of all, I have to say there's a little bit of NIMBY, not in my backyard, a little bit of NIMBY in all of us if we're really totally honest about it. And so, I empathize with neighbors and stuff. Everybody's concerned about their property values. People work hard for their homes and they pay a lot of money and they want to protect their investment. For some people, that's their retirement, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time is that we've been buying properties in the community. Thank God for the Fair Housing Act amendments of 1988, the Federal Fair Housing Act amendments made it where you cannot discriminate against anybody that has a disability. So you can't say to people, hey, lady, you got a mental illness, you can't live here. People can live there by right. So for years, we've been quietly buying properties in the community. It's zoned appropriately for multifamily, and people can live there by right. And we went about our business very quietly, never really had any problems at all. The day that changed is when we were going to build the Yale Apartments, and because Tulsa Housing Authority was our partner, some laws that govern them that don't necessarily govern us, but they were our partner in developing that property, it required a public hearing. And we got into a lot of NIMBY issues, what have you. But as I said then, let's not criticize those people. Let's educate those people. It's our job to combat NIMBY issues. It requires us to work very diligent to educate people. And that's where we started giving tours. And again, I want to remind your listeners that they want to come out and take a tour of our housing and introduce us, show us around. It takes an hour. I call it the hour that'll change your life. Come around for an hour and see and meet what have you. And I've given hundreds of tours, and I see it over and over again. People, basically, when it's over, the standard line is, I had no idea. This is very cool. And people feel good about it. And I've watched people feel good in the community. And the Yale Apartments, the neighborhoods near there, they've become great neighbors, great friends of ours, and we cherish those friendships. Our education efforts succeeded, and we didn't have to get into name-calling. We had to educate them, and I'm thankful for that. We live in a great community.
Besides housing, what else does the Mental Health Association of Tulsa specialize in? I saw there was on the website, at least, for survivors of suicide, survivors of violence. So you have other advocacy groups?
Yeah, we have support groups. We have the survivors of suicide for family members and friends of loved ones who have died by suicide. Again, these support groups are all free. They're in the evening. They meet a couple of times a month. You can go to the website and get the time and locations. And we also have – we do a cooperative support group with our local DA called Strength and Serenity. It's for – family members who have had loved ones who've died from murder. That's one of our newest support groups. We have a bipolar support group, a depression support group, an anxiety support group. These are all people that suffer from these ailments and live with them in recovery. It creates a place where they can come as an adjunct to their other services they receive. Our other big thing that we're really involved is out in prevention. So much of this kind of work is after the fact, but, prevention is so important, prevention in health care, prevention in mental health care. And we're out in schools working with students, with families, with faculty. We had 10 of our area teens kill themselves in the last 14 months. 10. We have a teen suicide problem. We have a severe bullying problem. And we are out there doing a lot of preventative things in that area, what have you. And I'm glad to say I can't say too much now, but I think some of our city leaders are really getting interested in trying to help out with the bullying issues. And we know some of the kids that killed themselves, the teens that killed themselves, it was directly attributed or connected to being bullied. And it's a serious problem. problem, and we've got to deal with that. So we're out in schools, working with schools, helping them deal with that, doing preventative work, what have you, as well as helping schools evaluate what kind of crisis plans they have should something happen. We've learned schools get pretty disorganized when they have a critical event, and we help them set up a plan, how to organize that, and then and we'll also consult with them if something happens. We'll work with them as a result of that, too.
How does the Mental Health Association conduct screenings?
Yeah, that's a part of our Columbia Teen Screen, and we've worked with Columbia University in New York, as well as 400 other communities, not only nationwide, but it's international, where Columbia University developed, the Department of Psychiatry developed a computerized screening, and we go out into schools. The school hosts us. We go in, we go around to different classes, and we do a mental health education class, educating students about depression, about other substance abuse issues, and we ask them, with their parents' written permission, if they would allow us to screen them. And it's a computerized screening. They sit down, they put headphones on, the computer program speaks to them directly, ask them a series of questions. It didn't take very long. And then a licensed mental health professional scores that screening from the computer and then does a clinical interview. And if a young person scores positive, we contact the parents and let them know that their child has screened positive, and then we refer them for further assessment in a more in-depth way. It's just a screening, and so this is really important. Again, we're providing mental health education as well as actually screening. Again, it goes back to that prevention thing, and so we're very proud of that. It's amazing because we screen in schools all over the area. We helped to get started in Oklahoma City. They screen over in Oklahoma City area too. We continue to have a problem in Oklahoma where while we have a lot of cool things going on, progressive things in mental health going and substance abuse going on in Oklahoma City and in Tulsa and the metro areas, in a general way, a lot of the rural areas are really, really lacking. We don't have enough services in the metro areas, but in the rural areas are really suffering. I think we've got a long ways to go there.
We're almost out of time, but I always sort of save the personal to the end. I just wanted to ask how you got involved in the work you do or what led you to your path.
Yeah, well, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I did for years. I did clinical work. I did family therapy. I did individual group family work, couple work with couples, what have you. But I always stayed active in various community involvement. I always try to teach my students, no matter how you practice, don't forget that larger family system called your community. And so it was a real natural thing for me to move into that. And I'm just thankful every day because I get to, try to, I'm on the back end of my career. I got some good years ahead of me, God willing. And I hope that I continue to get to work and do my work for a long time. But, it's so important. It's such a blessing to get to go out and try to leave this thing better than what you found it and try to help your community and help the people that live here. And, your listeners remember Dr. Ben Hennecke, who was a professor emeritus here, and I got to hear him early in my career, and he said something I'll never forget, which is to elevate the quality of life for one person is to elevate the quality of life for all of us. I heard Dr. Ben Hennecke say that, and I believed it then, and I believe it now, and I think it's a great thing to kind of live by.
Well, Mike Brose, you are an incredible advocate for your organization and the community. I just want to thank you so much for coming down today.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. It's a real honor to be here.
Mike Brose is the Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Tulsa. If you're interested in taking Mike Brose up on an affordable housing tour of Tulsa, just give him a call at the Mental Health Association of Tulsa at 918-585-1213. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on this program are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.